Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls One Planet series. Omega-3 fatty acids, more commonly known as fish oil, are one of the most popular and profitable dietary supplements in the United States. Every year, citizens spend $15 billion on omega-3 supplements and omega-3 supplemented products. The omega-3 fish oil market is expected to grow at a rate of 7% per year for the foreseeable future. Omega-3 fatty acids have long been celebrated by doctors and dietitians as key to a healthy heart and a sharper brain. But today's guest, Paul Greenberg, says a closer look at the omega-3 sensation reveals something much deeper and more troubling. In his new book, The Omega Principle, Seafood and the Quest for a Long Life and a Healthier Planet, Paul Greenberg tells the story of omega-3 fatty acids and how our quest for a healthier life has boiled down trillions of pounds of marine life into animal feed, fertilizer, and dietary supplements. So what is our relationship between the food that we eat and the oceans that sustain us? And also, how is fish oil? What is it doing to our health and the ocean's ecosystems? Paul Greenberg is an award-winning journalist and author of American Catch and the James Beard Award-winning bestseller Four Fish. His new book is called The Omega Principle. Hi, Paul. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me back, Rose.
Well, it's great to have you. We had you on a couple months ago, and we thought we would bring you back because when we did that show with you, it was a pre-taped Your Call. And
yep.
I know that listeners will have a lot of questions about fish oil, omega-3s, and what you found.
Well, I have to tell you that I'm actually very surprised by how many people engage with the fish oil stuff. Like, I never knew this would blow up the way it did. I did an article for The Guardian on fish oils and so forth. It was the most emailed article for The Guardian for the entire week. So
wow.
I'm not surprised that people have questions.
Well,
it baffles me sometimes.
I'm not surprised because, so we'll talk about this later, but I take the vegetarian version of the omega. And I went to the store the other day, and Nordic Naturals, one of the biggest fish oil companies, it feels like they now have several different brands of fish oil.
Yeah.
I mean,
well,
there's, you know, I think I saw at least 10 different boxes.
You know, one of the things I realized in writing this book was I spent a lot of time at natural food kind of conferences and supplement conferences. And, you know, you realize that even though we like to imbue alternative cures with a sort of kind of nice green glow around them, that they're just marketing stuff just like everybody else. And just like Toyota might have a Corolla or, you know, four different kinds of cars that you might want to drive, the omega-3 industry is ready to sort of satisfy that kind of not altogether logical desire to have different kinds of fish oil or different kinds of omega-3 supplements.
All right. So talk about just how big this industry is. Estimates show that it's about a $15 billion yearly industry. That's huge.
Yeah. I mean, it's quite large. It's not just the pills that are the $15 billion. And I've actually heard numbers up to $30 billion, but, you know, it's a little hard to pin it down. There's a lot of what are called omega-3 supplemented products. For example, baby formula oftentimes has been supplemented by omega-3. But it is up there with the leading supplements that Americans take and that humans take in general. And we're starting to really see actually a migration of the market, not just in the United States, but over to Asia, where in China and Japan, it's becoming a pretty big market there as well. So it's, you know, it's a big global force. But as I talk about in the book, the fish oil industry, the supplement industry, is really just a sort of thin film over this other industry called the reduction industry, which is, I think, probably what we wanted to talk about most when I came back on the show.
Right. Well, and I wanted to ask you, since so many products have omega in them, I mean, I feel like if you buy something in a box, there's at least 10 labels on it nowadays.
Of course.
So if it says this has omega in it, what are they talking about? Are they talking about fish oil or is it algae omega? And is there any way to know?
It can be a variety of different things. First of all, you know, there are vegetarian sources of omega-3s, which are not algae, but terrestrial omega-3 sources like walnuts, like flaxseed and so forth. But those are short-chain omega-3 fatty acids. They're what are called alpha-linolenic acid. There is a whole sort of sphere of thought in the omega-3 world that says these short-chain vegetable sources of omega-3 aren't going to do what we hope they're going to do for our brain and our heart, and that what we need are long-chain omega-3 fatty acids. And unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on which industry you're in, those largely come to us from marine sources, most often from these little silvery fish that get boiled down into fish oil.
Tell us more about these little silvery fish.
Yeah. Well, so there's this whole order of fish called clupeidae. They're called clupeids more in a kind of conversational way, although what conversation would include clupeid? But these are things like anchovies, herring, menhaden on the East Coast, all these little silvery fish that tend to be very hard swimming and as a result have high levels of omega-3 fatty acid in their tissue. These are, you know, we often think about the omega-3 as being this essential nutrient. But these fish are essential fish for the way marine ecosystems work. Without these little fish, you would be unable to go from the solar energy that shines upon the ocean is captured by plankton. You would be unable to get that energy over to the larger fish like salmon, like tuna, like all these larger fish that we like to eat. So if you will, these little silvery fish, anchovies, herring, sardines, they're translators of energy. They eat the plankton, and then in turn, they are eaten by larger fish. If you take them out of the middle of the ecosystem, then you're going to have fewer of these large fish that we all like to eat.
Is anyone studying how fish oil and the process involved in taking these small fish out of the ocean is affecting the ecosystem at this point?
Yeah, I mean, there's a pretty robust, I would say, kind of advocacy, not group, but set of organizations that have realized that there is this problem and that are looking at populations of things like anchovies, like herring, like menhaden. You know, the industry tends to counter that they are whatever fish in question is being managed sustainably. But the thing is, if you add it all up, if you add up all the herring, all the anchovy, all the menhaden, the total amount of these little fish that's being taken out of the sea every year is 25 million metric tons. That is a quarter of all the fish that are caught in the world, boiled down into dust and to oil. And I guess my biggest question is, okay, if you're so sustainable, what would the world look like if we had another 25 million tons of food for the large fish that we'd like to eat? In addition, the whales, the dolphins, the seabirds. It's really, really a very ignored question on a global scale.
25 million metric tons every year.
Every year. That's equivalent, by the way, to the human weight of the United States.
Wow.
So it'd be equivalent if you like scooped up all the people in America, boiled them down, and turned them into agricultural and supplement products.
When did this begin, and how long? I mean, how long has this been taking place? 25 million metric tons a year.
Well, you know, it has a very storied past, actually, believe it or not. I mean, really, when you get right down to it, the first reduction industry was whales. You know, back in whatever the 17th, 16th century, when people first started targeting whales for lamp oil and for a range lubricants and other products, that was the first effort to kind of take mass amounts of wildlife and burn it, boil it down into an industrial product. It should be noted, though, that there are actually two historical phases of whaling. The first one went up until about the early 19th century, but the most recent one, we're really very recently doing this kind of bad whale reduction. Around about 1900, people invented a way to hydrogenate oil. In other words, to bombard it with hydrogen atoms so it could become solid. And what did they do with that? They made margarine. Mm. Once margarine was created, it opened up this vast sort of gaping maw, desperate for more oil. And at the time, actually, Norway had just declared independence from Sweden. They were in dire need of cash. And so they sent fleets down to the Southern Ocean to Antarctica. And over the course of the next 50 years, the Norwegians, but also the Russians, and also the Brits and the Americans as well, they reduced schools of altogether 400,000 great whales, and we're talking about blue whales, gray whales, fin whales, humpback whales, they reduced those 400,000 individuals to 10,000, all for the purpose, basically, of making margarine, but also making explosives. Mm-hmm. So that's the historical precedent beyond the for the reduction industry. The more recent idea, you know, once we passed a global moratorium on whaling, and there are still nations that violate that, of course. But once whaling sort of came off the table, people started targeting these other things. And probably it dates to the 1950s and 60s when we started seeing really mass extraction of these little fish. And keep in mind that they weren't always just for omega-3 supplements. I mean, the omega-3 supplement is kind of something that was born relatively recently. We're talking like 70s and 80s. But before that, this reduction industry targeted these little fish, first for fertilizer, because all the soils of Europe and the Western and the United States had been depleted of nitrates and so needed some sort of fertilizer. So first we used them as fertilizer, then as chicken feed, then as pig feed, actually, because pigs, when we started to industrialize hog production and didn't allow piglets to nurse to the degree that they really are supposed to, they needed their own omega-3 supplement. So then, but we don't do that much of that anymore. Then we started feeding it to salmon and to other aquacultured fish, and we still do that. And then, of course, on top of it, this oily sheen, this valuable oily sheen of the omega-3 supplement.
And then it ends up in a pretty bottle and a pretty box on the shelf.
It does.
And there's so many brands now. Let's go back to that word sustainable, Paul, because this word is being thrown around from every corporation.
I just want to break in and say that I personally am totally sustainable.
I'm sure we all are, right?
As are you, Rose. Yes. I mean, you struck me when I met you as very sustainable.
well, what does that word even mean anymore? I mean, that could be a whole show. But when it comes to fish oil, what does the word sustainable actually mean?
Well, so sustainable from any fisheries perspective tends to focus on the ability of constancy over time in the presence of fishing pressure. So in other words, can you year after year harvest a certain amount of fish and expect a similar catch, you know, taking into account environmental changes, you know, temperature and so forth. But can you show that you can remove a certain amount of fish every year and have fish replace that removal at a reliable rate? And there are fisheries out there that are targeted by the reduction industry that seem to show this kind of sustainability quotient. But where I take issue with trying to appraise whether these things work or not from a sustainability point of view is that very few people are looking at these things in what is called ecosystem-based management. And what that means is that, all right, humans, we have our needs for these little fish. But there are all these other creatures out there, whales, dolphins, larger fish that we like to eat, cormorants, seabirds of all kinds. They need an excess. They need a buffer so that they can eat their share of fish, we get our share of fish, and then a certain amount remains in the water to reproduce for the next year. So I guess my biggest issue, and when I was looking at all these different reduction industries, was that I felt that, generally speaking, ecosystem-based management was not developed to the degree that it needs to be developed and not implemented to the degree it needs to be implemented. So if we could all go to ecosystem-based management, then maybe there'd be a place for the reduction industry. But right now, I don't think we're there.
Today, we're speaking with Paul Greenberg, an award-winning journalist, about his new book, The Omega Principle, Seafood and the Quest for a Long Life and a Healthier Planet. If you have any questions about fish oil and this massive $15 to $30 billion market. We're talking about fish oil, omega-3 supplements, and omega-3 supplemented products. So in the stores these days, so many things say added omega-3s. What questions do you have about it? Because there's been so many claims about how omega-3s can lead to a longer life, a healthier brain. Has your doctor recommended that you take fish oil or omega-3s? Give us a call, 866-798-8255. Paul has really studied how fish oil affects our health and also our ecosystem. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Paul reports that all told, the reduction industry removes from the ocean 20 to 25 million tons of fish annually, the equivalent of the combined weight of the population of the United States. We've done a lot of shows about overfishing, Paul. In fact, we had on Paul, his name is escaping me, the founder of Sea Shepherd recently.
Paul Watson.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, he's hardcore. He does not mince words. And he believes that if we continue down this path, that we could maybe have an ocean free of most fish by the year 2048. What is your research tell you?
Well, my research shows that, or tells that, it's not impossible to manage fish in such a way that they will, have more or less stable populations in the presence of fishing pressure. It can be done. It requires pretty careful scientific scrutiny. It requires investment. One thing that I think is a really good example is that you look at, like, Alaska, for example. They had a situation where the large amounts of the state were overfished, and in the 1950s, the Eisenhower administration actually declared Alaska salmon fisher a federal disaster. But since then, since we've employed scientific principles of management, Alaska salmon have largely rebuilt, and a lot of Alaska salmon fisheries are also in really, really good shape. So they prove that this can be done. Interestingly, though, because Alaska is such a sort of powerhouse of fisheries, a lot of the money that, fishing companies invest into the fishery, they have to buy the quota from the state or from the federal government. That gets reinvested into the science that monitors those fisheries. So, robust fisheries tends to mean robust fisheries management. Depleted fisheries, like, say, what we have back east with Atlantic cod, means that there's fewer and fewer dollars to go into maintaining the science. So you can end up in this really negative spiral over time.
And again, if the reduction industry is removing 20 to 25 million tons of fish from the ocean annually, where is this happening exactly?
So, the biggest fishery of all, and I talk about this pretty extensively in my book, is in Peru. Peru is the site of the Peruvian anchoveta, which is by far the largest fishery in the world, sometimes as many as 10 million metric tons. It's much less than that now, but at one point it was as much as a tenth of all the fish in the world were Peruvian anchoveta. But we also have seen the reduction industry working off of the West Coast, targeting sardines. Famously, not too far south from San Francisco, you had Monterey Bay, and we've all heard of Cannery Row. But Cannery Row is specifically about the sardine industry that targeted those fish, and that fishery largely was destroyed by the reduction industry. And where did all the boats and the factories and all the things that targeted that Monterey Bay sardine? Well, they all moved to Peru. Huh. So you can actually find the same infrastructure that they picked up and moved to Peru to target a different kind of little silvery fish.
Wow. Speaking of the Peruvian anchoveta, you write that in the last half century, anywhere from 2 to 12 million metric tons of anchoveta have been caught off of Peru every single year.
Yeah.
Tell us more about this fish and what has happened to the ecosystem there.
So this fish, again, people didn't really fish for them prior to probably, the beginning of the 20th century. The thing that was really targeted in Peru was bird poop, was guano, which was, in a way, the direct product of the fishery. So Before these huge fishing vessels came down and were targeting all these little fish, there was a tremendously large amount of seabirds. And those seabirds ate these anchoveta and pooped them out on these islands. And so they're this archipelago of what are called the Guano Islands of Peru. Mm-hmm. And during the 19th century, we actually sent warships down to harvest that guano and bring it back up to the American soils that had been so depleted by poor farming. Of course, in the 50s and 60s, people got beyond that. Once we invented the ability to produce nitrate fertilizers by using fossil fuels, we no longer needed the guano, so we went out directly for the fish. And that's really when that fishery started to take off in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Now, it does have better management than it's been. There've been huge total crashes of bird populations around Peru when the harvest was really over the top. Now we're starting to see the birds come back. The harvest isn't what it was, but nevertheless, it still makes you think, what would the bird population be? What would the whale population be? What would be all the possibilities for all these other kinds of big fish that we could eat if we kept many more of those little fish in the water?
Paul Greenberg is author of the new book, The Omega Principle, Seafood and the Quest for a Long Life and a Healthier Planet. Today we're talking about the 15 to 30 billion yearly market for fish oil, omega-3 supplements, and omega-3 supplemented products. We're talking about what this is doing to our health and what it's doing to the ecosystem. Let's go to Noah in Oakland. Hi, Noah. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Well, so my question is, for people who want to have some omega-3 supplements, obviously having a processed pill is not going to be as nutritious as eating a raw anchovy or sardine. So what would be the percentage of omegas that are lost when you are eating a pill versus if you were to just eat them fresh?
Thanks, Noah. So you don't exactly lose omegas when you take them in supplement form versus taking them in fish form. What you do lose, though, is an ability for the body to uptake those omega-3s and put them into, incorporate them into tissues. There's, of course, you know, the problem with omega-3 supplements and trying to figure out what works better, supplements or the actual fish, is, well, you can do a randomized control trial of a pill. You know, in other words, I can give you, Noah, a placebo, and I could give Rose the actual thing, and we could compare how your health did one way or the other. It's very hard to do a randomized control trial with an actual fish, right? I can't give one of you a fish and one of you something else and say, you know, that's a placebo fish. But that said, in the course of my research, every doctor I spoke to said that if you're, you know, if the ideal way is to get omega-3s in food form, mostly because your body is prepared to absorb them. You know, in the context of the natural systems that those omegas were nestled within, the body recognizes it much more readily than it would be if it's just a shot of lipid into the system. So, you know, that's what's governed the way I've been eating ever since I wrote this book. I do eat quite a few anchoveta, or if I can get Peruvian anchoveta, I try to eat those. Sadly, the Peruvian anchoveta fishery is 99% directed towards reduction, and only 1% of Peruvian anchoveta are actually ever used for human consumption. But you can actually, you can get quite a few omega-3s just by eating, you know, 6 or 7 fillets of anchovies every day. That probably would do it in terms of meeting that 500 milligram dose that many health professionals say is what we're looking for in daily omega-3 consumption.
Well, thank you for the call, Noah. We have an email from Maury, who says, 2 weeks ago, I met a man at Fort Funston. It's a beautiful beach here in San Francisco, who, like me, was picking up trash as we walked along the beach. He showed me videos of starving baby seabirds he rescued at Fort Funston because of the lack of krill in the sea. They become too weak to stay at sea. At least part of the problem arises from the over-harvesting of krill. An additional negative impact is warming temperatures, causing the krill to go deeper in the ocean to find the temperature they need so the baby birds can't access them. And then Maury writes, I had just bought a krill-based supplement, so will not continue to do that and will spread the word to friends who don't know how negatively impactful that is.
Yeah, so that's the krill thing is a really interesting part of the omega story, and I actually have a whole chapter in the Omega Principle where I went to Antarctica to look at the krill industry. The krill industry developed kind of as a response to the end of the whaling industry, because you had all these people who still wanted to fish in the waters of Antarctica, but no longer could you go for whales. And so Norwegian companies largely, and some Korean as well as Chinese, are targeting krill. I had a very funny conversation with the head of one of the largest krill companies in the world, and he was saying to me, he's Norwegian, and he said, you know, I said, well, why, you know, what's the point of a krill supplement? He said, well, you know, the krill is very bioavailable. It's a phospholipid, so it is very quickly absorbed into the stomach gut, and it's very good for that way. And I said, well, what is that? Why is that the case? He's like, well, you know, otherwise you have to take very large fish oil pill, very large, and I was like, well, why is that a problem? He said, well, you know, when you take this large fish oil pill, you're likely to get a fishy burp. And there was a sort of pause on the line, and I was like, are you telling me that you have a $200 million operation that goes down to the Southern Ocean and catches krill, which, you know, is whale food and penguin food, and turns it into this supplement so that people can avoid a fishy burp? And there was a kind of awkward pause on the line. So, it's true that, you know, people, one of the big ways that the krill harvesters promote their product is saying no fishy burp. And to me, that just strikes me as the ultimate in sort of fin de sec, you know, indulgence. That said, I must qualify a bit. Krill are the largest, particularly Southern Ocean krill, are the largest single species biomass in the world, and some estimates put it at 500 million metric tons might be out there. And they, you know, altogether, the harvest is probably 300 or 400,000 tons. So it's not a huge amount. Nevertheless, though, it begs the question, do we want to even have any fishing at all going on in the Antarctic, where, as I said before, the population of great whales has already been destroyed and reduced from a population of 400,000 to 10,000 individuals? Don't we want every little piece of krill in the water so that hopefully someday we might rebuild the whale population to some semblance of what it was before?
Well, we have a Facebook comment from Sebastian who says, leave the fishies alone. Omega-3 is in tropical fruit, zucchini, and chia seeds, among many other natural foods. And we'll talk about that more after a break. Today, we are joined by award-winning journalist Paul Greenberg. We're talking about his new book, The Omega Principle, Seafood and the Quest for a Long Life and a Healthier Planet. This is Your Calls One Planet series, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Calls One Planet series. I'm Rose Aguilar, and today we are speaking with award-winning journalist Paul Greenberg about his new book, The Omega Principle, Seafood and the Quest for a Long Life and a Healthier Planet. The omega-3 supplement and omega-3 supplemented products industry is about $15 to $30 billion a year. This is a massive, massive industry, and it's just expected to grow. Paul takes a look at how this sensation affects our health and affects our ecosystem. Very, very important information in his book. 25 million metric tons of fish are caught every year in the ocean. This is massive. And he just says, it's a really good question. What if these fish were left in the ocean to be eaten by other fish and to allow this healthy ecosystem to flourish on its own without human intervention? If you have any questions for Paul about his findings and his research, he has been writing about these issues for a long time. He's also author of American Catch and Four Fish. 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. So what about the comment we just got on Facebook, leave the fishies alone? And then Sylvia Earle, her deepness, you know, just an amazing diver, ocean conservationist. She says, if you do not rely on fish for your livelihood, if you're not living in a coastal community, you might want to leave the fish alone because we are in a crisis. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I've talked with Sylvia about this, and so it's a multi-tiered answer, as everything in this book tends to be. But first of all, the caller was saying that, you know, there's many other ways to get your omegas, be it chia seeds and so forth. Well, first of all, I do want to clarify that if you're eating vegetarian sources of omega-3s, that those tend to be what are called alpha-linolenic acid, short-chain omega-3 fatty acids. And the research that I've read anyway seems to imply that what we need are the longer-chain fatty acids that are coming to us specifically from seafood. That said, there are ways that we can do this without really messing up the fishies too much. First of all, we might consider eating things like mussels, clams, and oysters. All of these creatures are farmed largely. I mean, they're also wild, but they come to us mostly in their farmed form. Farming those creatures is actually very beneficial for the marine environment, removes nitrates and phosphates from the water, and actually creates structure and habitat for smaller fish. And yes, they're very high in omega-3 fatty acids. So that's one way we can do it. But there's another important thing, which I want to make sure we get to before the hour's up, which is that this reduction industry, this thing that takes 25 million metric tons out of the ocean every year, it is to some degree what powers the omega-3 supplement industry. But what's really driving the reduction industry is fish farming, aquaculture. Because most of those fish, you know, yes, they're making these omega-3 supplements, but they're also using a great deal of those little fish to feed things like farmed salmon. One of the things, and this is, I'm going to veer off a little bit maybe from the typical environmentalist's message. The typical environmentalist message is, you know, never eat farmed fish, you know, blah, 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 blah. I would actually take issue with that. There are ways to farm fish that are not particularly harmful to the ocean. Particularly, for example, one of the cool things I found out was that there's actually a way to take food waste, and keep in mind that Americans throw out one spoonful of food for every food that we eat. But there is a way to convert that into food for fish and then make aquaculture based on a recycling industry rather than a direct harvest industry. So I think we could do that. The other thing that's sort of interesting, which I'd love to, I need to have this conversation with Sylvia Earle at some point. I came across some really fascinating research being done at University of California at Santa Barbara. A guy named Steve Gaines did a big meta-analysis of the way that food affects the planet, the production of food. And keep in mind, you know, food is, after energy production, the largest source of atmospheric carbon. So when we're growing things like beef and pigs and so forth, we're really, really contributing to global warming. Fish, however, interestingly enough, the farming of fish can be much lower in carbon impact than growing terrestrial animals. Why? Fish float. So all of the energy that a cow puts into standing up, a fish puts into making meat. Another reason, fish are cold-blooded. So all the energy a cow puts into heating its blood, again, and then a fish puts into making more food. So I don't think we should throw out the farmed fish with the bathwater, so to speak. We just need to fix fish farming in such a way that it is actually not a sort of add-on to the human diet. I actually think that we all need to be eating much, much fewer pounds of land animal meat and shifting that demand over to well-cultured things like mussels, clams, and oysters, but also a reinvigorated new kind of aquaculture that is based on recycling rather than extraction.
And just briefly, another question about fish farming, Paul. Do you think as the oceans continue to be overfished, do you think that fish farming is inevitable? Because at the end of the day, industry wants profits, and they want to feed demand. So do you think fish farming is just going to grow in the coming decades?
Well, it's already, you know, it's the fastest growing form of food production on the planet. It's growing at something like 7 to 8% per year. So your question has already been superseded by actual events. So it's going to continue to grow. I think there's pretty much scientific consensus right now that if we were to rebuild wild fish populations to sustainable levels, the most we could get out of the ocean would be about 100 to 110 million metric tons a year for human consumption. But the demand currently is nearly double that. So already half of the fish that we eat is coming from aquaculture, and probably more of that will go in that direction. You know, do I want to see the ocean totally crowded over with fish pens and polluting the environment? No. But what I would like to see is something of a seesaw effect where we're actually reducing the amount of beef and pigs and chickens that we grow and slowly ramping up in a sustainable way aquaculture. And, you know, I know your phones might light up like, oh, how can you advocate for aquaculture? Again, do the research. Look at the comparison between how much it costs our planet to raise cows, pigs, and chickens versus raising fish. And lastly, Rose, I know that you're vegan, correct?
Right.
So interestingly, there's actually even been some research that has shown that a lightly fish diet, and what I call a pescatarian diet, that is, you know, a Mediterranean diet always calls for a very little amount of animal protein. The pescatarian version calls for that little amount of animal protein that we're getting coming from fish. So a well thought through pescatarian diet actually can be more carbon efficient than a vegan diet, believe it or not.
We might have to have a debate about that.
I know.
In the near future, Paul.
I know. I'm just booking my next show, Chris.
Well, it also depends on what kind of vegan you are. I mean, if you're eating fake meat, that's one thing. But if you're eating lentils and beans and, you know, greens and things, that's a completely different diet.
Yes.
And that takes a different amount of water.
But keep this in mind. So I know we're all about keeping the little fishies alive and keeping them in the water. And I'm not saying we should up the amount of those little fish that we catch. But let's say we got rid of the reduction industry. Let's say we cut the amount of fish, those little fish that we're taking from the sea. Let's say we cut that in half and doubled the price and made it for human consumption. Those little fish, anchovies, sardines, herring, all these things that are currently targeted by the reduction industry, you don't have to grow them. And in fact, because you use what are called midwater trawls, which don't drag the bottom, it's actually very, very low carbon to catch them. And it's much cheaper from a carbon's perspective to catch something than it is to grow something.
Today we're speaking with Paul Greenberg, author of The Omega Principle, Seafood, and the Quest for a Long Life and a Healthier Planet. And if you have any questions for Paul about fish oil, the research that he's done, just where we're at right now in terms of the state of our oceans, our ecosystem, you can give us a call, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Let's talk about health, Paul. You know, the thing that really concerns me about all of these supplements is that there's so many out there, and a lot of supplements do wonderful things for people. But I'm afraid that people go buy things without knowing what they need. And I cannot wait for the day that we have universal health care so everyone can get the blood test that they need to figure out where they're at. Because, you know, I'd like to have some naturopathic doctors on. Because they do these amazing blood tests. And, you know, you might find that, oh, yeah, you definitely need omega-3s.
Yeah. And actually, you know, there is a test. There's a company called Omega Quant in Sioux City, North Dakota, that will actually – or is it South Dakota? I'm sorry. I think it's South Dakota. Anyway, they actually – you can do a finger prick test, and they will tell you your omega-3 lipid level in your blood, so which is pretty interesting. But going back to the question of supplements, I mean, my biggest qualm with the supplement industry is that it really was created, you know, out of some people in the supplement industry were created it because they thought there was, you know, a needed health niche. But there's a lot of, you know, money involved in all of this.
Right.
Orrin Hatch, senator from Utah, actually he put himself through college by selling vitamins door to door, and he advocated for this thing called the Proxmire Amendment to the Food and Drug Administration's Act, and it basically creates this third category. So you have food, you have drugs, and now you have supplements, and they have nowhere near the regulatory oversight that food and drugs have. And I guess, you know, in this future day, hopefully, when we have universal health care, let's include in that a line item for doing rigorous testing of supplements, so that, you know, you can't just put some rose petals in a jar and say that, you know, it might help you with something. I don't agree with that. And I don't agree, you know, people are strapped. They don't have the money to spend on proper food. And I don't want people just sort of, you know, spending money right and left on stuff that isn't proven or hasn't had enough scientific oversight to show that it does something.
It's so true. And these supplements are expensive. The Nordic Naturals are expensive. They're in, I think, the $40 range.
You know, I don't know what I haven't priced them out recently, but, you know, certainly all kinds of supplements can cause all sorts of costs. And, you know, there's, I mean, geez, I've been to some of these supplement conferences, and it's like there are prebiotics and probiotics. And, you know, the thing that really struck me, and, you know, again, I worked on the Omega Principle for 3 or 4 years, so I was able to kind of see trends rise and fall. And supplements rise and fall almost like, you know, indie record releases. You know, it's like 1 year everyone's talking about prebiotics, next year everyone's talking about probiotics. But I'm sorry, you know, it's fine for an indie band to rise and fall, but actually debates over, you know, unproven debates over scientific validity of these things that cost consumers a lot of money, I don't think that that's really a useful thing for our society to be doing.
So what would you recommend if people are wondering, do I need omega-3s? Do I need a supplement, whether it's fish oil or a vegetarian version?
Yeah.
How do people find out?
Well,
the prick test?
Yeah, I would consider, you know, if you're really curious, do a finger prick test with Omega Quant, send it in and see what they say. Most Americans seem to have omega-3 levels below 5%. One of the things I did for research for this book is I went on an all-fish diet. People can see my Frontline episode, which goes into more detail than the book. But I ended up with omega-3 levels above 10%, which I was told by somebody would be the equivalent of probably what a Sicilian fisherman had in the late 19th century. So you can do that. If you do come out with low levels, few things you could do. One is you could try to get more things like anchovies, clams, mussels, oysters through food. You could also try to reduce your omega-6 level. One thing that comes out as a strand in this book is that, you know, the current food system is weighted very heavily to these things called omega-6s, which are also very, you know, essential for human health. But it used to be that we probably had an omega-3 to omega-6 ratio of 1 to 1. And now, oftentimes Americans have 10-to-1 omega-6 to 3 or 20-to-1. It's very, very out of sync. And why? Well, it's because we're growing a lot of corn, we're growing a lot of soy, we're making oils from those things, we're cooking our food in those oils, and we're also having a lot of corn-fed animals that we're consuming. So you might want to back away from things like corn and soy, back away from corn-fed meat, raise your seafood, raise your leafy greens. If you have fewer omega-6s in your system, you have a better ability to what's called elongate the short-chain omega-3 fatty acids from things like spinach and kale and so forth, and make those into the long chains that we need for our brain health and hopefully for our heart health as well. So that's something. Lastly, if you really just want to keep taking supplements, a couple things I would suggest. One is you could look towards an algal-based supplement. I was visited in the course of this book. I went to a place in Houston called Almega, where they make algae-based supplements, and those are the long-chain omega-3 fatty acids. You could also look at there are a couple of companies that are not targeting fish directly for the oil, but rather using the waste products of fisheries to make supplements. There's one company called Pure Alaska Omega that's made from the offcuts of the salmon industry, and there's another one called Wiley's Finest, which is made from the offcuts of the pollock industry. And I have no problem, you know, with fish oil supplements that are made from stuff that was just going to go into the garbage anyway. I just don't want to see fish directly targeted for the purposes of making supplements.
Well, and, sorry about that. I hope you didn't hear that on the radio. It's a very piercing sound.
No, I didn't hear it.
Okay, good. What about the health claims, Paul? Healthy brain, we need this as we grow older. You've looked at the research. What does it tell us?
Well, so there are two major areas for omega-3s. One is cardiovascular and one is brain and, you know, neurological functions. Cardiovascular has really taken a big hit in the last few years. And in fact, just as I was on book tour, Cochrane, which is a sort of public interest an analyzer of medical data, did what's called a meta-analysis. In other words, a study that studies that totaled 114,000 subjects. And they found that there was pretty much no effect on cardiovascular health, on heart attack, stroke. Interestingly, there was a small effect on – did you know, by the way, that half of all patients first report heart disease to their doctors by dropping dead?
Well, that's – yeah.
So that's this thing. It's called sudden cardiac death, SCD. And the omega supplements do show a little uptick in sudden cardiac death. So as I say, cardiovascular disease, generally speaking, in the last few years has really shown a lot of null studies. Neurologically, maybe there's more evidence for it, but I would advise all listeners out there to keep an eye out in November. There's going to be a very, very big study going to be published called the VITAL study. It's probably the largest omega-3 study ever done, looking at omega-3s, also vitamin D, across multiple health outcomes, including brain function as well as heart function. I've really got my eye on that. And even Jorn Dyerberg, who is the doctor who sort of put omega-3s on the map for cardiovascular disease, even he said if the VITAL study shows no effect, he's going to seriously question whether there is a cardiovascular effect of omega-3 fatty acids. So I'm really curious to see what happens in November. Other people are watching the elections. I'm watching the VITAL study.
Well, yeah, there's so much information out there. Let's take a quick call from a listener. Yep. Let's go to Danny calling from New Orleans. Hi, Danny. Welcome to the show. Do we have Danny? All right. I will ask. Sorry.
Call it the Big Easy for nothing.
No, it's okay. You're having some power. Oh, sorry. There is some power outages happening on the New York line, Paul, and it's really piercing my ear. Sorry about that. Okay. Let's see. Danny wants to know about toxic chemicals in supplements.
Yeah. Well, so there was a lawsuit a few years ago that was showing that was sort of concerned with the fact that omega-3s from menhaden might have higher levels of PCBs. And so that has been a concern. There are companies more and more will strip PCBs from omega-3 supplements, and that has become more and more a thing that industries do. So it's not as much of a concern as it was. But if you really want to be free and clear of any worry about toxins, probably it's better to head towards the algae direction because, you know, that's not really where PCBs are going to accumulate in the first place. you know, there's the other side of this coin is the whole question of toxins in fish in general. And I will say that after my year of eating seafood for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, I did have very high mercury levels. And one of the reasons people do take omega-3 supplements is to get their sort of omega-3 levels up without having a risk of mercury contamination. And I understand that. But I would counter by saying you can eat your way around the mercury. You can eat smaller fish. You can focus on things like mussels and other things that don't have high mercury content. And you can also, you know, just try to not eat fish every single day. Just as I say, a couple of portions a week should do it. That's it's not that complicated.
Yeah, we have another Facebook comment from Pat who says, I got mercury poisoning from farmed salmon when I was in Washington, D.C. in 2001. What about the vegan version of omegas?
Well, first of all, before I go to the vegan version, I'm curious that she got mercury poison from farmed salmon, because I, generally speaking, when I've looked at different studies and so forth, where I have heard PCB levels elevated in farmed salmon, I haven't heard about mercury being higher. So be curious to see what happens from that. Vegetarian sources of omega-3 fatty acids, well, as I say, algae is, to me, that makes the most sense, particularly algae that is algae that's grown using photosynthesis to generate its omega-3s. There are two ways. You know, algae are actually hybrid organisms. They do photosynthesis and respiration. And there are some companies out there that will kind of push they'll actually feed sugarcane leavings to algae to kind of boost their respiration, get them to produce more omega-3s. I mean, I could see, you know, it's sort of interesting, but I'm much more interested in the idea of having algae do their photosynthesis, which, you know, doesn't require anything from any sugar industry or anything to kind of bring the product to market.
And finally, Paul, what are you working on right now? I mean, what questions are you trying to answer at this point?
A large question is, what do I write about after fish?
Okay.
I mean, well, I've written this marine, what I consider a marine trilogy, you know, and, you know, Four Fish, American Cash, and Omega Principle. And to me, they stand pretty firmly as giving a good STEM set, you know, a good STEM curriculum's background and all the things you would want to talk about as far as the ocean is concerned. I do remain concerned about food and food systems. I'm going to be spending some time in Italy looking at you might remember in the Omega Principle, there's a bit about going to the Amalfi Coast with this company called Gustiamo. It's a small-scale artisan Italian specialty food importer. So I'm going to follow them for a little while, maybe for some magazine work, but maybe a book. We'll see. I'm interested in the health of how we eat. I'm interested with the health of the planet. And those two convergences will always lead you to interesting places.
Paul Greenberg is author of the new book, The Omega Principle, Seafood and the Quest for a Long Life and a Healthier Planet. Paul, thanks for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much, Rose.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. You can find more information about Paul's work at yourcallradio.org. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar.